When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Thank you so much for tuning into this interview for the Orphans Investigation. If you want to support the show, you can head on over to patreon.com/orphansaudio. There you can get a bunch more exclusive Orphans content. You can also follow us on social media at Orphans Audio, and you can head over to our website, orphanspod.com, for links for merchandise, Discord, and so much more. Hello, and welcome to another thing that we do on The Orphans, where we talk to people who talk about the show. This is Ella! I just decided to go off the rails early.
Okay, cool. Hi. Hi, Zach.
How are you doing? We have to pretend like we haven't just been talking for half an hour, and then we're like, oh, shall we record this then?
Yeah. Oh, gee. You know, I'm so excited to talk to you, Zach. We never get like this kind of FaceTime.
FaceTime. Yeah. We never speak to one another ever, and this is the only time we speak is when we're on mic.
Yeah, I mean, like, basically because we're audio professionals, yes, we actually can't have conversations by law unless someone is recording.
No, it's that's a funny little loophole in the BBC bylaws.
No, we can't bring the BBC into it.
No, I know. It's comedy, it's parody, I don't know, it's satire. I'm W1A, I'm fucking the edge of the truth.
Okay, you're right, this has gone off the rails already. Oh,
really quickly. Hello, we're here to talk a bit about The Orphans. We're gonna ask each other some questions. I'm gonna start with one question for you, Ella. This mm-hmm. You came on board The Orphans probably just about a year ago now. How has that year been for you?
Oh, it's been pretty great, actually. Been pretty great. I think I did start around like May last year, maybe
about
a bit
that time.
No, actually, I think it was March.
Really?
And you were doing investigation.
Yes, I cut the first three episodes or so.
Yeah, and you made me redo, I think it was episode three. You were like, do the scene from episode three to show me what you've got. What?
Show me what you got. What?
and I listened to it and I was like, gee, this is a real good show. So like, I just basically found an excuse to stick around you. And then I didn't, like, then I needed people to talk to about The Orphans. And because I'm like antisocial, I don't have enough friends to talk to about The Orphans. So I just started messaging you endlessly about The Orphans.
Yeah, I liked it. It was good.
It was fun. And then, like,
it was.
Since then, it's
still
yeah,
fun.
No, I've changed my mind. Zach, I've got something I need to tell you.
Fuck. You say that. I literally this morning sent you like a piece of script being like, ooh. Which is an often thing I do.
I think, yeah, like this year of the Orphans has been like fun in terms of making a podcast and also emotionally very trying in terms of the fact that like every other day you send me a bit of script and say, look, Ella, this is a new way I'm going to break your heart by hurting characters you love. Congratulations.
You make me out like I'm so much worse than I am. I'm pretty nice most of the time. Like, I feel like I've gotten this really bad rap on the Discord of being like, this guy who like mercilessly kills characters. And I want to refute that now. I want to come in here and I want to say, no, I am not George R.R. Martin. If I kill someone, it's for a reason. Shots fired. Come at me, Thrones fans.
Okay, so first of all, but sometimes you don't just kill characters, you just put them through immense emotional trauma situations. And I noticed that in the wording of that defense of yourself, you only specified that you didn't kill characters, which is like our problem isn't just with the deaths, Sag. Our problem is with the emotional torture.
They come out the other end a more I was gonna say a better person, but that's not true. They come out the other end having learnt something and having a better character arc. You love it. You all love it. You know you love it. Stop pretending. You wouldn't be here if you didn't.
Yeah. No, we are. I'm here for those good feels. It's true.
It's but good feels. I feel them too. That's the thing. We had a real nice, like, hearty discussion on the Discord the other day about, like, I think it was actually, you weren't in this conversation. It was in my secret D&D channel.
Oh, okay.
It was about how you know, I feel the character deaths too, guys. Like, I'm sad about them as well. Like, I described to them, like, how difficult it was to write these things and how sad I am, you know, when I have to kill certain characters. But it just has to happen for the narrative to flow sometimes, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the text that you sent James when you realized that you had to kill Baz in series one. Like, you were not a happy boy.
Such a good image. It was after that photo of a baby as well.
Yeah, and didn't you just say, oh god, I have to kill him?
No, I think it was like, James. I think it was fuck. I have to kill him. I don't want to, but I have to.
Yeah, and James for once like kind of broke character to be like, wait, what the fuck?
Yeah, I made James break character. It's always fun having him break character.
But no, I think you're like the opposite in terms of podcast writers in Britain who kill a lot of characters and have like violent shows. You're the opposite of Johnny Sims, because Johnny Sims went on Twitter and said that like he actively enjoys killing characters, like he really really likes killing like fan favorite characters. He likes killing characters that we've had a lot of emotional development with.
Whereas so like sad.
It's so mean.
I'm listening to Magnus now I'm really worried.
Oh yeah, you should be. You should be real fucking worried.
Oh no.
But you know, like, to be fair, on the flip side, yeah, a lot of people say to me, oh, you know, The Orphans is kind of grimdark or dark. And I actually don't think that's true. I especially don't think that's true after Investigation. Like, now that people can see that there's a lot of hope in the series. And you're right, like, characters go through horrible things, but they do, like, they survive them, they go through them. And, you know, in that way, it's kind of real. Like, I like the fact that, for example, Richard Hart, Diana Strange, and Axel, the Rad family, are found family. And I like the fact that they've been alone and that they've had a hard time connecting with other people, and that, you know, they're not easy to get along with necessarily, but that they find each other, because I feel like that's much more accurate and reflective of my experience as a person in the world. You know, I love the sort of Superman type characters where they're perfect and they're lovely and they never say anything wrong, but they're not me. I appreciate and respect the feels.
I don't think it's that dark all the time. Yes, there's a lot of darkness in it, like, don't get me wrong, but I think there's also a lot of comedy and humor and a lot of like really, really lovely feelings in it as well at the same time. And a lot of relatable feelings.
Yeah.
Like not that many sci-fi podcasts sit you around a dinner table with a family and show you an argument for 5 minutes straight with no music and make you feel really uncomfortable because it's too real.
I loved editing that scene so much. Like, I think that was like, that was one of my favorite scenes in the whole series to do. Like that scene, the scene where Richard is singing by himself.
Yeah.
The scene, like the whole of episode 4 was like agonizing. Like I swear to God, like when it got to the end of episode 4, I had sort of 5 takes for Gavin doing his sort of speech to Diana after telling the story about Olivia.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't choose. Like I must have listened to all of them like, I don't know, 9 or 10 times, because like each one was so good by itself. And every time I would stop listening critically because I'd just be so swept up in like the drama of it. And I would like kind of like, you know, like I'd get goosebumps and I'd be like, oh shit, like I am absolutely there in that moment. And then I'd get to the end of the clip and be like, oh no, I have to like pick one.
I have to listen to this again.
Because I stopped like kind of thinking critically about it.
It's a good speech. Gavin did that really well.
And I, and I mean, the ones that I hated to do were, I mean, everything in when Diana finally breaks down about Evers.
Yeah.
I think I messaged you at the time and was like, you know, like, I can't even do this thing. I'm too emotional. Like, listening to her just, like, breaking down. Like, because that's the thing as well, is that, you know, we know the actors. I haven't actually met all of the actors.
No. Nor have I.
But, which is weird.
I have met all of them.
No, but when like Laura does very convincing pain sounds as Olivia White, like I genuinely cringe because I'm like, that's Laura's voice in pain.
Why are my friends like, in pain?
Yeah, like it's really disturbing. And it's the same, like I haven't met Brooke, but I do really like Diana as a character, and I think Brooke's a great actor. Mm. And then I just have to listen to like 2.5 minutes of Brooke crying, and I'm like,
"See, but you." The thing is that you don't have the like the you don't see how the sausage is made with those rushes. Like, you don't see like her and I like recording that, being like, "How do we make this sound not terrible?" I was like, I remember directing Amy to cry in season 1. It's always those things. It's the laughing and the crying that we're like, the actors are always like, is this fine? This sounds weird. It's too over the top. I'm like, no, but you need to do it bigger so that it reads on audio. And they're like, okay, I trust you. I'm like, it's okay. And then I remember being like, Amy, open your mouth a little bit more when you cry. And, you know, having those similar interactions. So there's like a whole process in terms of getting those things right. The audio that you don't see when you're cutting it. So like I suppose I've got a bit more detachment because I'm like, yes, good open mouth crying, Brooke, well done.
Yeah, whereas like speaking of things that sort of make the actors feel weird but are necessary to the show, breathing stuff, like we really need the breathing.
Oh, yeah.
I think like the breathing is so necessary. And in a scene like the scene in episode 5,
oh god, the table scene, yeah,
we really, really, really needed those like non-verbal sounds.
Yeah.
But also like I you know, because obviously I listened to the the whole cut, I could hear the actors being like, do I have to keep breathing? And like I'm like, but you yes. Basically yes.
Keep breathing.
keep breathing loudly. Absolutely. Into the
and
microphone.
I think something I've done in the most recent ones is like after each scene, I've now done a breathing pass on all the scenes or as much of the scenes as I can. Like to be like, okay, we need to get you breathing in this way for that bit of the scene and that way for this bit of the scene. And I'll just be like, and I'll like let them run for like 30 seconds or so and then be like, and now breathe as if you're terrified. And now if you could breathe as if you've been told a funny joke.
But it's so useful. And but then on the flip side, in terms of feeling uncomfortable while reviewing audio, like listening to a minute of someone just breathing into a mic so I can find like the one good breath is It's a really weird feeling.
Okay, but I want you to imagine being in the room with that person, listening to their breathing in your ear as they're doing that.
Like, I know that this isn't how you have it set up, but I am just very entertained by the idea of them making full eye contact with you. Like,
very, like, thing is, the actors can't see me when they're recording. They're, like, facing away from me. And so, just for the benefit of the audience. So, like, oftentimes, like, they're just breathing there and they can't see me. And they have no clue if they're doing it right. They have no clue if I've just, like, nodded off. They're just there, like, is this fine? Is this enough? Every time with every actor, like, everyone from Beth there and Felix to Jack and to Amy, like, all of them are like, is that fine? Is this enough? What are you having me do, you maniac? But the really gratifying thing is when I, like, come back after I've finished it and been like, so the breathing really paid off, didn't it? And they were like, yeah, it did. And I'm like, yeah, I know what I'm doing.
A good sigh in that impression of the actors, you know, we should use that sigh. Yeah. Good one. So I feel like this is I'm gonna force a segue here because I've got questions I want to ask you. I feel like we've been talking a lot about how the actors make their characters feel like people. Like, jokes aside, like, things like breathing and laughing and crying do make them feel more like a person than just someone who's reading words off a page.
Yes.
And so I was wondering, from your perspective as a writer and director, when you're writing a new season, when you're making a new season, do you make the plot fit the characters, or do you make the characters fit the plot?
A bit of both. It depends on the season, and what kind of needs to happen in it. I think most of the time the plot fits the characters. That's kind of the basic thing. But there are some instances where, for things to be cohesive as a whole piece, I need to make certain characters make certain decisions. But that means that I need to lead them down that road and make their making that decision convincing. And that means seeding things very early on so that if I need someone to make a decision or do something for the plot, it doesn't feel contrived. That's very much my angle with that. I think primarily, as much as I can do character, the stories are character driven, just because I find those to be the most convincing plots. You know, like you said, the characters feel real, they feel like they're making real decisions. It never feels like they're being, like, driven through a story. They're walking themselves through the story naturally, and that's kind of the goal. Yeah,
because it's something I find really interesting about Orphans generally, is that you do have this big complicated plot, and you've known where it, like, you've known what the end game is from the start.
End game.
And I knew you would make
April
that joke.
26th.
Wow.
Sponsor. Sorry.
What, Marvel sponsors the Orphans? We will get sued. No, they don't. Marvel with an F.
Marvel? Marvel? Yeah, Marvel's the Avengers.
Yeah, Marvel's the Avengers sponsors the Orphans.
Yes. Yeah. Avengers Fend game.
But even though you've got these big complicated plots, you like, the conceit of the Orphans with the clones especially feels like a very character focused conceit, like this idea of having variations on a theme and exploring questions of identity and, like, how far you can have, like, one character deviate from their core values before they become a different person.
Yep.
Like, how confident can you make a Baz before they're not a Baz anymore? And I was just wondering, like, kind of from your point of view, when you were first coming up with the idea, was it that you were like, oh, I'm going to do this big space opera with conspiracies and rebellions and wars and politics? Or was it, oh, I've got this neat idea about how to explore characters, or was it both?
Definitely. I think the onus was the character thing. It was the conceit of clones,
And then from there, I kind of took this idea of, okay, if a society had all of these kind of clones and different people and had them, you know, performing different things, what would that society look like? And out of that, I kind of grew this idea of the collective. And then I thought, well, an alliance would exist, you know, some kind of pushback against it. And kind of that's how I developed it from there. So it very much started with kind of near the end of season one, when I knew kind of like, I knew that that was the twist pretty early on in that, but I didn't really have what the world implications were that were for that. I just kind of alluded to it and I left because I didn't want to trod on anything that I might end up doing later on. So I very much just hinted at a world and then thought, okay, now I need to figure out what is this bigger picture here, because I'm about to jump into it. And I developed, yeah, what is the world? What is the history of this? How did this come to be? But very much the original conceit was that I would have, you know, all these actors playing various different versions of themselves. And that's always been really fun to do. And I think they really enjoy doing it. And it's always led to fun storytelling opportunities.
Yeah, I think some of my favorite sort of actors that do that, like, I love the way that Alex does different Bazes and the way that Amy does different Noras. Like,
yeah,
just because just listening to their like outtakes, listening to them figuring out, like, you know, what's this Baz going to sound like? What's this Nora going to sound like? And listening to them switching between different Bazes and different Noras is like...
Do you have that take of Amy doing Vass and Taylor at the same time?
Yes, which is insane. Like, I mean, especially because, like, I do audio production. Yes. It is, like, literally my job to pay attention to how someone's saying a line and see whether or not, like, it feels like a natural pause between lines, like, whether it feels like, you know, whether they are using the same voice. And that one take, like, it wasn't just that she was switching, like, at the speed of light between two very different characters, but also the fact that she was inserting natural length pauses between, like, Taylor and Vass, and, like, having Vass cut off Taylor, and, like, you know, and then Taylor, like, kind of, you know, hesitating, and it was insane. It was so good.
I know, like, she was like, just let me do one take like this, please, because normally we always do, like, we record the clones separately, so, like, we'll power through one character for, like, the whole first few episodes, and then we'll go through the next character for the whole first few episodes. Like, we don't tend to intermingle them so that they don't get confused. But Amy was just like, let me do this scene once with both of them. And I was like, okay, go on. It was really fun.
It's one of my favorite things. But also, yeah, so wait, like, because I think that there's something else there as well, which is like, I'm really interested to know that you actually had the clones first, because I suspected that might be true, but I don't think I've ever asked you that. Like,
yeah, no, I had the clones first. Very much so. That was kind of like, I didn't know what the whole world was before I had clones. Like, I didn't develop the collective first. I didn't, like, I think I figured out they were clones probably about, like, one or two episodes into writing. I say one or two episodes. I think I had it from episode one, like, just because I seeded a lot of things in there. I think I knew from the beginning, now that I'm talking about it, having developed it. I had a lot of inspiration from Orphan Black, because I loved what they did with that. And what I wanted to do is take what I felt was the next natural step in that, expanding it to kind of like a mass production world. I wanted to expand it to multiple people in a way that they didn't really do fully. And I wanted to kind of show off more characters than just the handful that they had.
It's funny because I know that Orphan Black was like one of your influences, but I think early on that's something that we kind of made friends over back when we weren't friends already.
Oh yes.
And was that we both really enjoyed Channel 4's Human.
Yes.
And
yeah.
I feel like the way that society kind of treats the I can't remember the specific name they give them, but like the robots in that series, like, reminded me a little bit of the way the collective treats clones and those questions about humanity and identity.
Yes, very much so. And that was kind of
those are the themes that I wanted to explore kind of going forward, was identity and ownership of self. And I really needed, yeah, season one to kind of set up kind of our baseline, if that makes sense. Because I don't think you can have, like, the variance without seeing the baseline. Like, Sarah in Orphan Black, because you don't get to the clones until kind of, like, you don't fully get to the clones until episode, like, 3. And that's where it kind of really takes off and being like, oh, shit. And you see all the different variations of this person. And Sarah really serves as that baseline in that show. So I needed season one to demonstrate what is the baseline of these people and how do we go from there.
Yeah. And I guess actually also Orphan Black is a good kind of counterpoint to Orphans for. I think one thing you do quite a lot is use character archetypes, but you don't always. So, like, you know, Richard Hart is a very Han Solo-esque lone agent, and or Nora Evers is like the inspirational but flawed rebellion leader.
Yes.
And then on the other hand, you have characters that really aren't archetypal at all. Like, I'm not sure necessarily what archetype Diana Strange is. No. Like, she's kind of the grumpy one, I guess.
I think I definitely play with archetypes and I try to twist them where I can, you know? Like, I think with Richard Hart, for example, you know, we're very much playing into that Han Solo, you know, guy with a heart of gold, but really, he, you know, wants to be bad, but can't help but be good. But also, like, there are some things that I'm doing with him kind of in the future that I feel, and you know about this, like, in terms of things that have happened to him in his past that I feel like really are going to change how you see that archetype in him and, like, changes and kind of explains things about him and why he feels certain ways about things. And I feel like it takes the archetype and twists it. And I really enjoy doing that. And I think I do that with, yeah, Nora Evers. I definitely do that with Nora Vass massively, especially going forward. And that's always something I've really enjoyed is taking what you think is going to be the way this character is and just twisting it slightly so that you see that thing and it goes, oh shit, of course, like making them into a person, not just an archetype.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you, but we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Linsky.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I've definitely sent you a lot of messages, like, swearing at you for making me, like, sympathize with Nora Vast, which I never wanted. Yeah. I never wanted to, like, actually think of her as a person, and now I have to, and it's rude.
Yeah.
But I also think, like, yeah, with Richard Hart, I do know about future plans.
Mm.
I think he's a lot kinder and also more vulnerable than Han Solo. Like, I think ultimately Richard Hart is a nicer person.
Oh, then Han Solo, absolutely. Han Solo is an asshole. Richard Hart's quite nice.
He's a parent, these guys. You know, like, that's all he is. yeah. Oh, man. Let's see what other questions.
Yeah. I mean, hang on. I must have a question for you. Let me think. Ella, you have been kind of working about behind the scenes, expanding on the history of the Orphans world through the medium of role-playing games.
Mm.
Can you tell me, and by me I mean the audience, a little bit more about what you've been developing and what you're trying to bring to the world with that? And when, obviously, they haven't really seen any of it yet, but they will do at some point. Yes.
Yes. Okay. Where to start with this? Okay. In Investigation, there's a scene where Rich and Diana go to Amos Dent's house, and in his house they find a Jeffrey unit, and on that Jeffrey unit is a program labeled the Baked Goods Program. And
pastries and baked goods.
Yeah, pastries and baked goods, which also I can't believe that we've never seen fan art of Jeffrey, like, in an apron, like, making cupcakes. But, you know, side note. And then they go into that and they get a recording of a deep and dramatic voice, who we might presume to be someone significant in the Orphans universe, saying, like, this sort of poem song thing. And then you find out from Delilah Malik that that was the marching song of the first Clone Rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love clones, and I really love rebellious clones. And so I messaged Zach and was like, hey, Zach, can I, like, tell the story of the first Clone Rebellion? And he was like, And I was like, can I make it an RPG? And he was like, And I was like, it'll be great. Trust me. I've made a shitty PowerPoint with a lot of, like, really bad graphics and memes explaining why we should do an RPG.
Yes.
And I think that that was what sold you originally, was the shitty PowerPoint.
No, I think you told me what you wanted to do. I remember that very differently, Ella. I remember being more like, we should do an RPG, and I was like, cool, that sounds like it could be really fun. That's my recollection.
Like... No, yeah, and I mean, actually, I didn't originally want us to record it. I just offered it to you because I found out that you hadn't played D&D before. Yes. And I was like, it would be a way for us all to make friends, as we can just get pizza and beer and play this game. And the actors, like, can just be their own characters. So they don't have to worry about making new ones. And I'll set it way before the Orphans so that they can kind of build. We can collaboratively build on sort of the history of the universe.
Mm.
And then I came up with, like, a world and stuff, and I pitched it to you, and you were like, we should record this, though.
Yeah.
And, and that kind of led into what we are calling Rebellion, which is an actual play RPG set 200 years before what's currently canon in The Orphans.
Yes.
And you very kindly, Zach, let me kind of have this period 200 years before the Orphans as my kind of sandbox. So yeah. I've been expanding it out and exploring like the history of the universe and also how we got from point A to point B, mm-hmm. you know, because I don't think that collective society has always felt the way it does in the Orphans universe. Even before the Alliance, I think mm-hmm. like something led to it kind of getting to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to explore like what that might have been and how that might have worked. So it looks a lot into the different ways that natural borns and clones used to interact with each other. And yes. Some of them very bad, but some of them very good.
Yeah.
And very positive. And looks at how the collective kind of set a precedent for how it was going to deal with rebellion. Because like right now in the Orphans universe, something that I find really interesting is that like clones are scared. Like mm-hmm. I think that one of the reasons that Catherine and Baz Gilroy in Facility don't get along, and something that I find really interesting, is that Baz is so frustrated that Catherine just doesn't get it. Yeah. She doesn't understand why he can't just like leave. She doesn't understand why he can't just say, oh, well, it's fine. I accidentally birthed a Catherine and this will have no consequences.
Mm.
And I think for him, like I've talked to you about this before, Zach, but like for the sake of the listeners, I think that for Baz and for clones generally, there's this kind of thing that, you know, you don't talk about it. No one wants to talk about the fact that if you step out of line, you're dead. No one wants to talk about the fact that like, things are scary and hard. And like normally clones, there's just kind of this agreed understanding, like the silent understanding that like, obviously I can't say no. Obviously I can't just leave. And the fact that Catherine is making Baz Gilroy like confront this thing, that like this really ugly truth he doesn't want to confront, I feel like is a big source of conflict and tension between them. At least it seemed to be to me as a listener.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah, I feel like something in the history of the Orphans universe led us to this point. Like, there's a reason that both clones and natural borns are really scared of rebelling. And if the Alliance has only just started or, like, starts sort of after Facility, then there has to have been something before the Alliance, like a time when people did rebel and they found out what happened when they did that. And that's the thing that people are scared of. And, yeah, the Collective has controlled that history like any dictatorship.
Oh, yeah.
But also, like, the people who do try and stray from the margins and the people who do try and rebel, I imagine that they quite quickly find out like what happens to people who do that. And the Collective has systems now, you know, the Collective has processes for how they deal with rebels. There has to have been a time when they came up with those processes, when they decided how they were gonna like kind of suppress any kind of deviation from the norm. And so all of those kind of questions feed into the story of rebellion and the sort of surrounding material and the world building, the characters. Mm-hmm. And so we did a playtest with you and Bethan Headley from We Fix Space Junk and Liz Campbell, who does a lot of work on Wooden Overcoats and Victoriosity.
Yeah.
And we sort of ran the story to see how it worked, and you all broke my game.
Yeah, thoroughly. That was the goal.
I mean, I did ask you to break my game because I wanted to kind of find the limits of it, but at the same time, you hardcore broke my game.
I mean, Liz just came into that with the idea of, we're gonna break this game. Like, so I think we did a great job.
Yeah, okay. And then once we'd kind of established the story and Zach and Bethan Headley and Liz had helped me figure out like what was happening in the setting and sort of what could happen, then we recorded it with Amy and Alex and James. James not playing Jeffrey.
Yes.
And also Pip Gladwin, who is a voice actor for Wooden Overcoats.
Yes.
So then we're sort of editing that recording, which is Rebellion, and we would like to release it as a series one day.
And yes, as soon as we fix some audio problems, which are my fault.
I mean, it was all
yeah.
I mean, we made Rebellion, but Rebellion really fought back, which, you know, makes sense.
Yeah,
that's the name.
Rebellion definitely fought back.
Yeah. And then I'm also working on a quick start guide, which for people who don't play RPGs is sort of designed to let you like just quickly jump into the game and the world of the game. So it's just a one shot, like a one off adventure. It's quite simple and has kind of pre-prepared characters and monsters so that you can just like hang out with your friends and try playing a game in the Orphans universe. And then I may or may not also be working on a longer actual full on manual, which has a lot more monsters and characters and settings and world.
And we're developing now the next section of the story, aren't we?
Yeah. So like what happened? So I am actually, the thing that I am most proud of with the Rebellion was that in the playtest, we got to the end of the playtest and I used Zach's words against him as as anyone who has ever listened to the Orphans, I think, has always wanted to do, just to kind of like get some payback on all of those like horrible feelings.
Yeah.
And so we got to the end of this like self-contained story, because Rebellion is very much like a self-contained story. And I kind of closed it and I made Zach cry.
Yeah. It's true.
And I was very proud of that moment. Sorry, Zach, I love you.
No, it was good storytelling. It was a good, you knew what you were doing.
Thank you. And then, you know, I kind of thought the playtest was over and I was like, okay, cool. Thanks, Beth, Headley, Liz, Zach. That's that. And they were all like, actually, can we keep playing, please? Sure. I was like, oh, fuck, I guess I have to like build more planets now.
So you made a planet, which is now, I feel like I was speaking with James about this, about what stuff he's developing. You're developing a lot of stuff kind of in the history, which kind of I'm taking and integrating into kind of season two and onward and other things that we're doing to kind of make sure that everyone's world meshes together right now.
Yeah, which I love. Like every time you refer to something, and I mean, in my one mini episode that I've written, I couldn't help referring to some of my stuff as well, because I just wanted to. But like,
which I think people are going to hear very soon. I think at the end of this run of interviews, which I think this is going to be the last one, the next thing, the next week, is going to be the live show.
Oh, exciting time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love referring to other stuff. So I refer to sort of planets and things that James has built in my games. Like, even stuff that we don't record, I refer to planets that James has built, and I'm like, oh, this character is from that planet. Yes. And stuff like that. And I love it.
I just want to mention that in our most recent episode, we were like, I think there was like, we were all pretending to be like three reporters from Contrac, which made no sense. Contrac is a farming planet. Like, we're all like, so one person was a blogger, I was a reporter from Contrac, and then the others were like, we are also reporters from Contrac. And I'm like, really, guys? That's all we're gonna do? Okay, cool. Good luck.
Yeah, like, PSA to anyone listening to this, my players are a disaster. If there are any DMs out there who share my pain, please get in touch. I'm thinking of building like a support group
hotline.
I love you guys. You're really brilliant players. And actually, some of your, and like, there is part of me that really wants to, or maybe, I don't want to make any promises, but would love to kind of write up some of the stories that came out of the playtest as well, because
yeah,
I think there were some really cool moments.
Definitely.
But yeah, so like the planet you're on now, you've referred to quite a lot already in the scripts for season two. Just mentions and stuff, but which is Sagara, which is probably, I love Sagara. Sagara is my baby.
Yeah,
Sagara is an ocean planet that is it's my baby.
I wrote you something a very long wiki page and how I'm gonna use it going forward, and you were very upset with me.
Yeah, I'm not gonna say like what that is because it's a spoiler, but I am gonna say that you're like a child with a sandcastle, Zach. I built the sandcastle and like baby Zach came over and like we all know what's gonna happen next.
I'll put it back together again.
I don't trust like that.
No, fair. Reasonable to be expected.
But yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And it's actually interesting because, you know, on our Discord, you mentioned earlier that you have a secret D&D channel now. I also have a secret D&D channel where I update everyone on the story of the playtest game. Mm. And so I let them know what's happening. They also know, from my perspective, like what I'm planning and what, like, you know, if there's any kind of, if I'm tricking you guys or if there's any like other things going on that you guys haven't figured out yet, then the people on our Discord know about it. So they'll kind of be like, you know, have they figured this out yet? Or like, have they realized what's happening with this person?
And you're just like, they refuse to hook into a plot.
you just hooked into a plot. I know. So it's like,
I know, but only just good. After having played this for quite literally months. Like, I don't want to understate this. Months.
I mean, there's a reason that I attacked you with giant squid.
Yeah. It was payback for not hooking into a plot fast enough.
Yeah, you guys, I'm like, listen, I've built this whole planet. It's got 8 cities on it. There's this big political conspiracy. There's this biennial marine festival that lasts a month. There are these parties. There's a black market. There's like this really cool like kind of scene. There's a secret city of like refugees. And you guys are like, we want to go fishing.
Okay, hang on a second. You can't just, we needed money. We really needed money. We were trying to wipe our names off the collective records, and that takes cash. Cold hard cash. And you were like, you can make money by fishing. And we were like, great, mini game time. And then you killed us all.
I didn't kill all of you.
No, just one of us.
You and Laura, and to be fair, I didn't kill you. Our guest player harpooned Laura's character.
Oh, that was so good. That was so good. And they were trying to help. They were really trying to help, and they rolled a critical one at the worst possible moment.
Yeah, like, I think it was, like, on Laura, because Laura obviously plays in Olivia, and it was on her last death save, and this guest player was like, I'm gonna harpoon the squid. And then they got a critical one on her last death save. Like, and by all means, you know, by all rights, she should be dead. And I just want to point out that I'm a really nice DM alive. Who yes, gave you an ambulance. True.
That's very fuck, that was a funny game. I say funny, it was terrifying. Like, I don't think I've ever felt so genuinely on edge, like really invested in something before like that. Like, you get that way with some stories, but like, I was personally involved. Like, it was me and Laura, me and my loving partner, with her, about her character about to die, and me being like, well, fuck me, I guess I have to fix this now.
It was, yeah, I mean, it was a good session. I think it was exciting and also interesting because in Rebellion, like in our playtest of the first story, which I'm kind of, I personally refer to your playtest as the broadcast investigation, and sort of season one as Rebellion and season two as conspiracy. And in Rebellion, like, I think all of you kind of managed to mostly avoid dying. The only person who got close was Nora, Headley's character. Oh, well, there was the bus, but also she in the factory.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Remember when we were all healing each other in turn in that cyclical healing? Because we kept dying and I would heal Beth, and then then I would die and Headley would heal me, and then Headley would die, and then Beth would heal Headley, and it was just cyclical. Like, it was like ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
And then a collective warship came in and you guys were like, fuck, we better run.
Oh god. That was a bad time. I remember that now. That was also the time that Liz tried to climb on top of me. And we fell. That was a good anyways, we're just talking about RPG memories. Do you have any more questions, Ella?
I mean, like, I had a couple that I think we kind of covered, like, why must you do this to us?
Sure.
I do have a kind of mean question, which is, like, who's your favorite character?
Oh. I don't have a favorite character, per se.
But there are certainly characters who I get a lot of joy from writing. I have always really enjoyed Nora Vass. I think any time I got to work with her was especially pleasing for me. I love all the characters, but Nora Vass, I've got a long game for, and that's always been really fun to develop. And you'll hear more of Nora Vass in the live show next week.
That was a good episode.
It was a real good episode. I'm pleased that that was the one we did for the live show. I feel like people really reacted to that. I feel like James's and yours, like they're more disconnected from like kind of the main plot. And then I enjoyed kind of coming in and just swinging like this like main connected character being like, by the way, canon guys, bye.
I just imagine you kind of like blowing a kiss to the audience and just like yeah, sweeping away.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wish I could have done that. If I wasn't like manning the sound, I would have done that. Who's been your favorite character to edit? Who's your favorite performance?
Ooh. Ooh. Cause like you know who my favorite character is.
Yes, I do.
But my favorite character is Eddie.
Like, who, when you get to do one of their scenes, you're like, ooh, exciting.
Kind of. I mean, like, I was quite excited to be able to do Ruby and Matt just because.
Oh, yeah.
Because Xavier and Valerie weren't really in the season. And so it was like the first time that I got to edit a Xavier and a Valerie.
Yeah.
And that was exciting. But I didn't get to edit them enough that like I have. And then I also, I'd enjoy doing Jeffrey, but like you kind of put so much onto Jeffrey that it's not exactly the same. Oh, this is tricky. Yeah,
that's true. There's a lot of processing on Jeffrey's voice.
Sarah Golding does an amazing job as Minister Autumn.
She does.
And Deck always surprises me by having a much deeper voice than I expect. Whenever I'm like going to William Unit, especially if I'm going from like Gavin or Alex, yeah, and then I like go to Deck and I'm like, this is, and it's almost like it makes it feel more fictional because I'm like, oh, this is such a deep voice.
I do have to like pull down the bass in Deck's voice quite a lot.
Yeah, it's a very deep voice. But no, like, okay, no, serious answer. I love doing Richard Hart and Diana Strange.
Mm.
I love their quibbling. Like, I love Brooke and Gavin just like really getting into it and kind of getting the sense of humor. And I think, because obviously you read against them.
Yes.
But I like it when they've kind of warmed up enough that they start getting sassy with you. Like, kind of like,
yeah,
you can hear the kind of like sarcasm in their voices. And I think they did a really, really good job of transitioning over time from like sort of quibbling at each other and being genuinely annoyed to moving into like kind of like fond exasperation. Like, especially Brooke as Diana, just being like, oh, I mean, I guess like, you know, I'll look after you and stuff, but also, oh, you're a pain in the ass.
You know what I've always felt the transition point for those characters is between those two things? Is at the end of episode 5. Do you know the bit where she's trying to put together the relay?
Yes.
And she can't.
Yes.
And he comes and helps her. That for me is that's the moment where it flips over and she decides to trust him, and he puts himself out there for her. She puts herself out there for him, and they kind of come together a little bit.
Yeah, I definitely see that, because he could have just been a dick. He could have been like, I know how this works, but I'm not going to help. I'm just going to watch you struggle. And I feel like Diana's very used to people doing that, like, in the Alliance. I think she's quite used to people kind of being like, I'm not going to help you. I'm just going to leave you to do it by yourself. And I feel like there's such a theme in terms of Richard's relationship with Diana of, like, him letting her know that she doesn't have to do everything alone and that it is okay to ask for help. And And I mean, like, honestly, so also just like as a sincere addition, like, Amy and Alex are very exciting for me to edit because they're like Baz and Nora. And before I started working on the series, they were the characters I'd heard the most. And so I'm always like, oh, this is the orphans, because like I hear their voices and I'm like, oh yeah, like this is the show. Yeah,
Baz and Nora are the orphans.
Yeah, but then for me personally, because I came on to the orphans for investigation, like Richard and Diana are my protagonists. And I do feel like a genuine affection for Richard and Diana, like specifically Richard Hart and Diana Strange. And I really admire Brooke and Gavin's performances, because like for me, like, yeah, they're kind of my protagonists. They're my series. And so I think I'm always gonna have like a slightly irrational like affection for them. And I'm always gonna kind of feel like, yeah, this is the story that I came onto, and this is like kind of like where I feel like I joined. And
No, that's reasonable. I love those characters. I love those two so much. And the whole Rad family. It was something that when I kind of, I don't know, it came about less constructed than previous things had, because, you know, I had written season two originally, you know, immediately after season one, people know this, but Diana was in that, Richard was in that, and Axel was in that, but they weren't that unit that they were. And I think those three characters were the ones who most radically changed between that original draft of season two and where we're at now. And I feel like everything we're doing going forward is so much stronger for me having taken the time to figure out what that relationship is with them. And I think that family bond unit is really the strength of where we're going right now.
I really agree. And like, I know Brooke talked about this as well, but like, for me, a big part of the orphans is like kind of themes of found family and as like, as well as identity, like these kind of families that you build for yourself. Like I personally think that like, or the impression I get from the orphans is that the way that clones kind of live their lives is by finding their people. And absolutely, that isn't necessarily romantic. Like, you know, like it's not just, this is someone I want to have sex with, or this is someone I want to be in a relationship with. It's like, these are the people I would die for.
Yeah.
Even though they never wash their dishes, kind of thing.
Yes. And, no, exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think like, you see that in season one with that group of people. Like they very quickly form that bond to each other.
Yeah. And then that's what's so heartbreaking about Facility, because you kind of, you almost expect, like, especially Gilroy and Catherine to like, to be that for each other. And then they're just not, and it doesn't work. And like that really like hurts, because they, you know, that bit where he takes her up to see the trees, you're like, okay, like I can see this forming. And then it's kind of cut short. And
God, yeah, I mean, that I think scene. I love that scene so much. That's maybe one of the scenes I re-listen to most, like, of anything. Like, that is maybe just one scene that like, if I had to point to anyone and be like, what is the one culmination of, like, everything you wanted that scene to be, with the music, the performances, like, that is definitely up there. Like, there are lots of other moments, like, through all the series, but that one is way up there. That scene of those two looking at the trees and the mountains and just breathing for a minute, like that, oh fuck, I love that scene.
Yeah, I love the quiet scenes, and I also love the scenes where we remember like there's a world around the characters. Like, and for me, like a moment when I fell in love with orphans as a series was the opening scene of Facility, and when it's like raining on the spaceship.
Oh, I love that.
And
isn't that good?
Yeah, and like, and just sort of Gilroy and Richard, and it wasn't that it was like Facility itself that made me fall in love with orphans. It was that transition from season one to Facility, where there's like a Baz and a Richard, but they're not the Baz and the Richard I know, and they're immediately recognizable as like different characters. Like, you immediately know who they are. And then that was just like this kind of like goosebumps moment where I was like, oh wow, like this is actually like a world and a universe, and it's so much bigger than I thought it was. And like, yeah, that was a real special. I remember where I was, and it was raining when I was listening to that scene for the first time. Yeah. And I was walking to work. I was tutoring someone, and I just like, and I just sort of walked up and down the pavement because I just wanted to like keep listening. Like I didn't want to break out of that for even a second.
Oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. I love any, I think there's just something really interesting tell with me is like, if I'm like ever like in a place where I'm like, I'm not really sure what I think the atmosphere of this place is. I love defaulting, not defaulting, but I love going to rain. Like, I think rain really grounds a place. Like, because I think we see a lot of places that are, like, really gorgeous vistas and, like, all that. And it's like, yeah, fair enough, you see a lot of that in science fiction. But you don't see necessarily a lot of places that are raining and a bit gritty. And I think it immediately conjures, like, a feeling for the place and for the weather. And, like, you understand a climate, like, more than you would if it was just all stunning vistas or all desert all the time, if that makes sense. Because you know what light rain feels like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think, like, it's also, like, it sort of, it immediately gives you as the listener some instructions on what kind of sci-fi The Orphans is, right? Because, like, for example, I love The Expanse, but The Expanse doesn't take place in a universe where there are habitable planets or multiple habitable planets. And then you get sci-fi kind of, like, even something like Lost in Space, and it's like, okay, there's weather here. And I think something that I like generally about it, like, I love the rain, I love the weather generally, I love it when there's windy, I love it when there's like bells like in clock towers in the background. And I think there's something about that where like it's just not an idea you think of very often. Like, you're listening to a sci-fi show, like an audio drama, and you know you're on a spaceship because you can hear like the hum of an engine and occasionally an AI and some cool beeps. But what I never think about is like a spaceship coming into an atmosphere and it raining on a spaceship.
Yeah.
and I think that that's the thing where I'm just like, oh, wow, like now I feel like this is a world I live in. Like now I feel like this is a world so close to my own, but so different. And I can imagine the physicality of it. And I can imagine kind of standing in the mud. And I can imagine like, you know, Richard Hart, like in the wind or just like being a bit irritated or, you know, someone like being in the sun or there just being a light breeze. And I think so much about the thing about audio that's so intoxicating is that it happens in your head. But it's also, I think, surprisingly physical. And I think that's something that people sometimes forget, like, is that when I hear someone breathing, it's not important to me because I can hear it. It's because it tells me that I'm standing right next to them. Like, that I would only hear that if I was standing so close to them that I was essentially touching them. And that is intimate and that is physical. And so when you have things like weather and I know what rain feels like, then it grounds me physically, in that place. And it makes me feel like it makes me feel like I can feel it. And that is just so exciting and just awesome.
Rain. There we go. That's Ella and Zach talking for a little bit about how rain impacts audio fiction. There you go. shall we wrap it up? Because I think we've been recording for just about an hour now.
Wow. Yeah.
thank you very much, everyone, for listening to us talk about The Orphans and about fiction in general. You can find Ella Watts on social media at where?
So you can find me on Twitter at GEJWatts. I don't really use other platforms, but if you find me on Twitter, you can tweet at me, and I'm always happy to talk about The Orphans or audio fiction more generally. Or come chat to me on the Discord, because I'm one of the people who's on there.
As am I. What is the easiest way to find that Discord?
So we have a link to it on our Tumblr, orphansaudio.tumblr.com. We will also be adding it to our website, and we've essentially got like an endless invitation. If you can't get hold of that, tweet at The Orphans account or tweet at me, and I will send you an invitation to the Discord.
Can't you search it as well? Is it a searchable thing?
It is, but like because of the way the Discord servers work, you have to get an invite, so it's a little bit of a a pain, but we do make sure that we often post on our Tumblr about it. And again, that's orphansaudio.tumblr.com. I run the Tumblr. Please come follow our Tumblr. And we share the links as much as possible, but also just don't be shy. You can always kind of send questions to the Twitter account, like that Zach and I run together, or to me, and we'll kind of pass you any links that you want.
Yeah.
If you want to support us, for example, we do have a Ko-fi or Ko-fi, I don't know how it's pronounced, but we do have a Ko-fi account, which means that, like, if you're not able to sign up to something like Patreon and you're not sure about, like, doing a recurring donation, then you could just give us, like, a one-off. Yeah, if you just finished investigation and you're like, holy shit, I just realized it all ties together, then you could show us that feeling of holy shit by giving us, like, $2 and letting Zach buy a coffee.
200,000.
and then there's a lot of, like, bonus material on our Patreon as well, if you want to kind of check that out. And those links are always on our website, they're always on our Twitter account, they're always on our Tumblr.
And you can follow myself at ZachFG on Twitter and Instagram. So there you go.
Zach, is that Zach with a name? Z-A-C-K. Or Zach with a K?
Z-A-C-K. Z-A-C-K. F-G. Zach. Z-A-C-K. F-G. For Ford is Gone. Twitter and Instagram. yes, so thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you soon on Discord or on Twitter or anywhere else. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And, spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.